Now, at the age of 60 and having lived with Parkinson's disease for over 10 years, Guy Deacon set out on one last adventure, and he's here to tell us all about it. It's great to have you on the show, Guy.
Thank you for letting me come and join you.
You're very welcome. Now, it's not easy. You drove solo from your home in the UK. You drove 18,000 miles through 25 countries to Cape Town on the southern tip of Africa. I mean, that's hard for anyone, but to have Parkinson's disease as well makes it doubly hard.
The thing about Parkinson's, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. And I had plenty of time, and I thought to myself, if I have bad moments, which I was going to have along the way, I just had to rest up and wait for it to pass. And then when I was fine, I'd be able to carry on my normal way. And as long as I didn't rush things and get stressed out, I thought I'd be all right.
Blimey. How long did it take you?
Well, the whole thing took 3 years, of which 2 years were spent back in the UK because of COVID. And so the travelling itself took a year. I could have gone quicker, but I was held up by various things, such as visas, which I needed from various places, and some mechanical breakdowns, I'm afraid to say, as well.
And were you all right with your medication? Did you have to take that all along with you?
I had tons and tons of the stuff in my van, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
That was the limiting factor. And I had a resupply due to come and meet me in Sierra Leone. So that was okay. But in the end, I came back anyway. So I had a chance to top up properly for the next part. But it was a lot of pills I had to have. And that, of course, made me feel quite uncomfortable because I met many people who had no pills at all.
Wow. You met other people doing the same thing?
No, I met many people with Parkinson's on the way through. Because
I understand.
Yeah. When I started off, not really worrying about it, because I didn't know about the state of play of Parkinson's in Africa. I knew about it in the UK, and I was doing it because I was trying to satisfy a childhood wish to do this trip. I was always going to do it anyway. But when I actually came to going, if that makes sense, I was going to try and draw attention to the fact that I've got Parkinson's, and with Parkinson's, you can still live your dreams if you want to. It's more difficult, but you must never give up trying to do what you want to do. And it was a message to those people back in the UK who had Parkinson's. And also, because I would be honest and very realistic about how I was feeling along the way, it was an excuse and a reason to allow people who worked and lived with people with Parkinson's to understand what they're going through. Because Parkinson's is not just a physical condition, it's a mental condition as well.
I'm sure it must be. I mean, it's a great attitude to have, but in order to write the book, did you have to keep a diary through your journey then?
Yes, I did. And I kept, it's quite funny, actually. I kept a diary, which I generally dictate because I can't write very well and I can't type very well. So I dictated into a document on my laptop, which I carried with me. And before the spelling came out dreadfully badly. And when I came to rereading it, I could hardly make out where I'd been or what I'd been doing. It made no sense at all.
Sounds like me when I'm trying to text someone, and predict a text just changes everything.
Absolutely everything. And words come from nowhere. How on earth did that happen?
Well, we said it sounds tough. I mean, it's something I don't think I could actually do. But it's not just tough for a human being. I mean, you've got to have the right vehicle. It's tough for the vehicle as well, isn't it?
Yes. And there were times when I didn't think I had the right vehicle. And in retrospect, I think I probably did. I took a VW camper van, which was four-wheel drive and had been improved by Bulkstrek, based in Aberystwyth, by a chap called Rob Willis. It had Under Armour protection, had improved suspension, a few other bits and pieces, which made it better. And I did some things to the inside to make it more livable with for a year. And actually, it was pretty good. Because the reality is, most of Africa, there are Africans driving around in two-wheel drive cars going the same place you are. So you don't need to have a muscle-bound 4x4 machine that can go anywhere. Occasionally, you might want to, but the best thing to do is to avoid the place where you're going to get stuck and try and find a better way around. So you don't need to have the most aggressive 4x4 you can imagine. Mm. And I have enough to go where I need to go. And only on a couple of occasions did I get really badly stuck. And there was always help to get me out. So it was satisfactory in that respect.
So you went to some remote spots, I would imagine.
Well, a lot of it's remote. And funny enough, in some ways, the most remote bits are when you're approaching a border crossing point. And that's because these countries seem to be very much internalized. There's not much overland trade going on. And I avoided the big crossing points because they were always busy and they had lots of official sort of customs people and police and all that sort of stuff. And I'd find a small crossing points to go through. And the roads to them were sometimes completely undrivable, almost unworkable. And that was because nobody ever did it. Mm. And so my 4x4 was required most of all to cross the borders sometimes.
And do you have to work out how much fuel you need until you get to the next sort of, I guess, filling station?
I've been to Africa for a few times over the years, and there are three big changes which have occurred, which make life really quite easy in comparison to the old days. First of all, the mobile phone coverage is pretty good. So I'd always buy a local SIM card so I could use my maps and that sort of stuff on my phone, my iPad, so I could work out where I was. So map reading was not really a big problem. Secondly, the days of traveler's checks are long, long gone, and there are cash points in most capital cities. So if you know where they are, and there's a great app you can get on your telephone which tells you where all the cash points are, then you can get hold of cash. That's easy. And the third thing is there are fuel stations, and quite good ones at that. They seem to be the most modern shops with things to buy in them at the fuel stations, and they're reasonably well sort of positioned. So I took some spare jerry cans, but I only need them on a couple of occasions because there are some very good fuel stations along the way. So it wasn't a problem that I thought it might have been.
Yeah, I would have thought lack of services in certain areas, but clearly not, which is good news.
Well, there was a complete lack of. From Morocco down to Namibia, there wasn't a single VW service station that I could go to and get things fixed, and I had some problems.
But
the local mechanics are so good, and I suppose that most cars work in the same sort of way, but the locals are absolutely brilliant at taking things completely to pieces without any guides or any help, without any instructions, and incredibly putting it all back together again so it works. It's extraordinary. And I've got... I had two clutches which required the engine to be lifted out almost completely, all the things to be taken off the vehicle, and they did it and put it back together, and it worked. Couldn't believe it.
blimey. And what about the weather? I mean, if you were doing a year, you must have gone through lots of different seasons.
Well, I left in November deliberately so I would be ahead of the rainy season, because especially from places like Sierra Leone, along the Bight of Benin through Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, Togo and Benin and all that sort of area, the rain is dreadful. And the roads that aren't sealed with tarmac become impassable. So I was desperate to stay ahead of the rain as much as I could, because once the rain caught up with me, then you almost get stuck and you can't go anywhere at all. So I was very conscious of the rain. And certainly for that middle bit, I managed to stay just about ahead of it most of the time. And if I hadn't, I would have been stuck for a long time.
You mentioned Sierra Leone. It's just made me think places like Libya, Mozambique, maybe. Were they dangerous places to be?
I don't think so. And I didn't think so at the time. Only on a couple of occasions I remotely frightened. That was because built to be a campsite, was actually nothing more than a scrapyard, really, which somebody had let me camp in. And that was uncomfortable because there were some sort of dope-smoking people in ruined cars hanging around. I didn't like that very much. And I was threatened by a chap in Nigeria when I was trying to buy some fuel, who was obviously out of his head on whatever he's out of his head on. And South Africa has a dreadful reputation as well, but I had no problems. But I didn't have any trouble at all with people. In fact, quite the opposite. People were extraordinarily friendly, and as soon as they knew what I was doing and why I was doing it, they were just totally on board and totally supportive. And I had help in every country I went to from different people I'd never met before and would never meet again, who couldn't have been kinder to me. And if ever I had a problem, I didn't rely upon it, but people would just come out of the woodwork and they would always be there to help me. And when I was in Gabon, for example, I hit a very big pothole and damaged the car quite badly, and the shock absorbers were at 90 degrees, the wheels were not straight up and down. And the first car that came along stopped and said, was I all right? And I said, no. And he stopped and started to help me. And the next vehicle was a big truck, 18-wheeler coming along. And the driver got out and he came and helped. And those two people stayed with me from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon till over midnight to get me back on the road and to get the vehicle in a movable state to get it down to the next place where there was a garage. And I don't know who I know what their names were, but I've never met them before. And they took me down to this place and they came back the next morning to make sure I was all right. And they just were really, really, really fantastic people. And that story repeated itself in many, many countries as I was going through. And it was a sort of help that you just wouldn't possibly expect to get in a country like this.
Yeah, that's so nice to hear. And apart from those lovely people you met, were you completely alone?
I started off alone, and I was quite happy to travel alone as well, because I find it easy to be alone, because I can follow my own timetable. You're not responsible for anybody else. You haven't got to worry about anybody else. You just drift on quietly, and if you feel like stopping, you can just stop. Some friends came out on a couple of occasions to travel with me, and towards the end, after I went back out after COVID, my Parkinson's was a bit worse, was noticeably worse, And I needed somebody to come and help me. And that tied in with a chap called Rob Hayward making a film. And so he was with me filming me some of the times. He came out four times and helped me on some of the driving as well, because it was a manual car, and with Parkinson's, control of your feet and hands can be difficult in your down moments. And if I was under pressure to move on, I couldn't do it. But with Rob there, we could cover a few miles when we needed to. But so I wasn't alone the whole time. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a fraud in that respect. I very much intend to be alone most of the time, because you meet more people and you see more of what's going on around you, and you have a richer experience in some ways. But I needed help towards the end.
So is there a documentary being made about it then? Or has it been made?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And it's going to be, it's of the same title at the moment, and it's going to be shown towards the end of the summer, the autumn time, on
Excellent.
Channel 4.
Excellent.
And Rob's got some fantastic footage of not just me, in fact, definitely not, there's no good footage of me, I'm just ordinary, but in the van, the extraordinary driving, and the people I met. And what we were trying to do was, by the time I was engaged with Rob and he was involved, I'd met up with Parkinson's Africa and was desperate to show the story of Parkinson's in Africa to people in Africa and to elsewhere. So I appeared on many, many radio stations, television programs, newspaper articles, telling people about Parkinson's, because in many countries it's simply not understood or known about. And because people don't know about it and haven't heard of it, they assume it's some sort of witchcraft and people have been cursed when they've got it, which is a horrible thing. And lack of knowledge means people die a very lonely, miserable life because they think it's contagious. So nobody goes near them and they're left to die in however long it takes. And it's a horrific story.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't need to be that way. And the thing they need most of all is love and care from their families, and they weren't getting it, like some of these people. It's a horrible story.
Yeah, just about raising awareness a little bit, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's everything I'm trying to do. Every muscle I move is about raising awareness of Parkinson's so that people understand what it's about. And in Africa in particular, just letting people know that it's not contagious and people can still be loved and looked after makes people's lives worthwhile. And without that care and attention from those nearest to them, they just might as well not be there. And I know of one person who would literally pray to die the next day because she was having such a horrible time. She did eventually die out there, after 5 years of suffering on her, by herself, locked away.
That's terrible.
Desperate story.
Yeah, terrible. And I think, to be fair, there's a lack of knowledge, even, you know, in the UK and here in Spain. I mean, I was just reading from your website that it's the fastest growing neurological disease in the world with no known cure. I didn't realise it was the fastest growing.
Yeah, that's partly, I think, because people are living a little bit longer. There might be something environmental going on, pesticides or something like that, but the numbers are creeping up the whole time. And people don't know much about it. And for example, people think I probably shake and quiver and do all the sorts of things that normal Parkinson's people do. And I don't. I'm very static. I have a different sort of type and I can't move. I sometimes get completely stuck. You know, to get out of a chair and go through a doorway, my balance is so bad, I can't lift my feet off the ground, and I have to really concentrate to move at all, and I can't pick things up, and I can't write, and I can't use my fingers and hands, can't use a mobile phone, can't type, and it's a lack of movement for me, whereas it's the excess of movement in other people. And everybody has a slightly different version of Parkinson's. It's like a family of problems. So there's no one sort of ideal cocktail of tablets to take, because we all have slightly different problems.
Yeah. Well, you said you're ordinary. I think you're far from ordinary, Guy, really far from ordinary. And I'm in good company because Sir Ray Fiennes thinks the same, and so does the author, Gilly Cooper. So well done you.
Thank you very much.
Now, the book and apparently the Channel 4 documentary is called Running on Empty, 18,000 Miles Down Africa with Parkinson's. It's by Guy Deacon, who's a CBE. Is that because of all you're doing for Parkinson's?
It's not actually. I was a soldier for my career, and towards the end of my time, I did some bits and pieces and bits of work which were recognised publicly, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Because the other thing of this, the army employed me for the last 8 years of my career when I had Parkinson's, so I carried on as much as I possibly could. But partly because I had no choice, but mainly because I was in denial and I kind of ignored the fact that I was ill, and that meant that I could carry on regardless. And dare I say it, if you think your way through the problem, you can probably get through the problem. And when you dwell upon your Parkinson's, it seems to be worse. But if you just ignore it and pretend it's not there, you can kind of get away with it a bit and live as normal a life as you can. Hard work as it is sometimes.
Yeah, good advice. And if people want to find out a little bit more about you, do you have a website that people can go to?
I do, and it's incredibly simple. It's guydeacon.co.uk, and it tells a lot about the story of the journey. The countries I went through are all there, so people can find out more about where I went and how I enjoyed them and all the rest of it. There are links to Parkinson's charities as well, so that people can know where to go if they want to learn any more about Parkinson's. They can donate to my own foundation, which is all about raising awareness at the lowest level, where a small amount of money goes a very long way. And, of course, they can get a link to buy the book and lots of stuff as well. So there's as much information as I could put on there. And the other thing, you'll be pleased to hear, there's my playlist, which I used to play all the time as I was travelling along.
Ah.
So you can see the sort of tunes I listen to.
Ah, I'll take a look and then I can find out what sort of music you like. Guy, it's been a delight to chat to you. Thank you for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.